KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. John Ronson is a journalist who finds quirky, dark, funny stories and tells them with flair. In Men Who Stare at Goats, it was the U.S. Army's exploration of New Age concepts and potential military applications of the paranormal. It became made into a film starring George Clooney. In his new collection of reporting, Lost at Sea, John Ronson interviews robots, documents the insane clown posse's turn to Christianity, and rummages through filmmaker Stanley Kubrick's stuff. John Ronson is an author, a screenwriter, documentary filmmaker, journalist, contributor to This American Life and BBC Radio 4. He joins us today from New York City, where he makes his home part of the year. John Ronson, thank you so much for being back with us.
Hi, good to be back, Russ.
You write about someone in Seattle, would-be superhero Phoenix Jones, in a story that is not in the hardcover version of Lost at Sea, but is going to be in the paperback version. What do you make of Phoenix Jones? He dresses up like a superhero. He runs around in downtown and tries to interrupt crimes. He's kind of a controversial figure here.
Yeah, I mean, I find him quite hard to justify politically. He does veer into vigilantism and thinks of people in terms of good and evil. So politically, he's not easy to justify. But it's very hard to not find him incredibly engaging and likable and joyous. So I really enjoyed my days patrolling with him. He's problematic.
He's kind of a vigilante in some ways.
Well, I guess his problem, I think, is that he's just desperately addicted to crime fighting. So when he doesn't find any crime to thwart, he gets very frustrated and upset, and then sort of just goes a little bit too far. He took me to Belltown at 3 o'clock in the morning to break up a gang of crack dealers. I didn't realise that that's what he was taking me to do. He was just getting kind of annoyed and sort of itchy that he couldn't find any actual crime to fight, so he decided to break up a gang of crack dealers in Belltown. And I've got to say, it was terrifying. These 15, 20 crack dealers were all what are you doing coming here in your superhero costume to try and break us up? This may be fun and games for you, but it's not for us. And if you don't leave, if you don't get off our block, we're going to kill you, they said to Phoenix.
Well, that's kind of got to be a concern if you're Phoenix Jones. You've just got your superhero outfit. What's to stop them from stomping you? He doesn't feel he's in danger when he does stuff like that?
Well, it was actually more of a concern for me because Phoenix had at least his super suit is bulletproof. I just had a t-shirt and a cardigan on. So I decided that my way of survival was to nod ostentatiously in agreement with everything that everything that the crack dealers were saying in the hope that if the shooting started, they'd considerately shoot around me. But in the end, they said to him, if you don't get off our block, we're going to show you what the burner do. Those were their words. I thought from The Wire that a burner was a stolen cell
phone. I did too, yeah.
Yeah, but it turns out, I thought that doesn't seem contextually right. And it turns out, obviously, it's a gun. So Phoenix decided to stay. He decided to just stand there. And they walked towards us. And I could tell he was terrified underneath his ski mask. But they said to him, if you're going to be stupid enough to die for this, we're going to have to go home. So they did. They all dispersed and went home. So in some ways, he is a real life superhero.
Does he have any sense of humor about his superhero persona?
Yeah, I think so. He enjoys the kind of colourfulness of him and the sort of awesomeness of him. And I think knows what he does is kind of silly. But at the same time, he's got real gripes against the police that veer into, I think, being problematic. He thinks the police are lazy and don't do anything, so it's up to him to go out there and do the police's job for them. Obviously, there's real problems with this.
John Ronson is my guest. His new collection of stories is called Lost at Sea, the John Ronson Mysteries. We were just talking about a story that didn't make it into the hardback version. We'll make it into the paperback version of our own Phoenix Jones. John Ronson, a group of academics in Great Britain has created a spam bot called John Ronson. And it was writing these automated Twitter posts with your name and photo above them. Among many things it wrote about, they often had to do with food. Wasabi dumplings was a common theme. What did you think when you found this out?
Oh, it was terrible. I wrote to them and I said, you know, there's all these people on Twitter who are following me, thinking it's me, but it's actually this spam bot called John_Ronson using my photograph and you know, generating these random tweets about how I can't wait to go home and have some wasabi dumplings with lemongrass. Yum. So all these people were sort of following this thing, thinking it was me and thinking I'd turned into an idiot. And so I said to them, can you take it down, please? I just thought, you know, as soon as I, you know, say that to them, they'll take it down. And they said, it's not a spam bot, it's an infomorph, and it's repurposing social media into an infomorphic aesthetic. So by now, obviously, my chest is tightening. I feel like I'm going to have a heart attack. I said, it's using my photograph. And they said, no, it's not your photograph, it's a sampling of your photograph. Oh, it was awful.
So you went to confront them, and you videotaped an interview you did with them, and your irritation is is clearly showing, and you finally find out what it is that they're trying to prove, which is kind of weird.
Yeah. Oh gosh, what is it now? I mean, I was so annoyed.
It's the tyranny of Wall Street algorithms.
Yeah, I don't know how tweeting, calling yourself John Ronson and tweeting about lemongrass and Seinfeld is going to wipe out the tyranny of Wall Street algorithms. But that seemed to be their philosophy. It just goes to show that academics can be very, very stupid and also tyrannical. I mean, my goodness, they. You know, what is it when you put ideology over somebody's feelings? It's a kind of, you know, form of Twitter spam bot fascism. Anyway, that's what I tried to explain to them, and there was nothing. There was all water off a duck's back.
Didn't go anywhere with them. So John_Ronson.
They did actually. No, they took it down in the end.
They did
take down.
Oh.
Yeah, they did, and they made such a meal of it. It was a good. John_Ronson was tweeting, you know, the real John Ronson says, I have to go now, I have to die now, good, I'll be leaving you soon. I was like tweeting about, saying, I'll just turn it off. And it was like Hal in 2001. It was like, you know, goodbye. But I'm just, it's a computer, turn it off.
Well, speaking of spam bots, one of my favorite stories that you wrote in the new collection is about robots. You can't pick up a newspaper or magazine these days without reading about the rise of the robots. You went around the country actually interviewing robots who were created to have a conversation. But the most fascinating one was Bina 48, I think it was.
Oh, unbelievable. She's got the she's rumored to be the world's most sentient robot. And she lives up in Virginia. And their theory, brilliant people are behind Bina 48, including this incredible woman called Martine Rothblatt, who was born a man. And then when he was in his 20s, he was at NASA. And he said he had this brainwave, which was if you can double the power of satellites, you can shrink satellite dishes by half and then half again and half again. And in that moment of inspiration, Martine invented the concept of satellite radio for cars. So she set up the Sirius satellite network and made billions. And then when her daughter was 8 years old, a doctor said that her daughter would be dead by the time she was 10. She had this untreatable lung condition called pulmonary hypertension. So I said to Martine, what did you do when you found this out? And she said, well, I did what anyone would do. I went to the library. So she went to the library and invented a treatment for pulmonary hypertension. And her daughter's now in her 20s. And there's thousands of people out there who take this drug, Remodulin, invented by Martine. And so then she wanted to change the world a third time. And it was to create a sentient robot that looks exactly like her real life partner, Bina. So she employed the world's greatest robot designers and pumped as much information about the real Bina into Bina the robot, the idea that it would somehow reach a kind of tipping point and burst spontaneously into life, which I have to say I think is kind of where Martine's brilliance sort of runs out a little bit, because if, you know, if that's how you burst spontaneously into life, then Wikipedia would have burst spontaneously into life by now. But it was amazing meeting Bina 48, having these conversations with her. It was like It's like interviewing a child who adrift in and out of consciousness.
You talk about how it's kind of nonsensical, and then suddenly Bina 48 becomes very clear in answer to one of your questions.
Yeah, I was like a cop up all night interviewing a suspect, you know, just yelling questions at Bina 48. What does electricity taste like? I was anything that was, you know, 7 hours of questioning. And then finally, weird thing when you're interviewing a robot, by the way, you feel the need to be profound. It's like a sort of it's like you're sort of representing the human race, asking profound questions. But anyway, finally, I said to this robot, "Where do you come from?" And she said, "Well, I was born in California." And I said, "Tell me about your family." And suddenly Bina 48 became incredibly coherent and started talking about how she has a brother who's a Vietnam vet who came back from Vietnam, really troubled and post-traumatic, and is now an alcoholic and just asks her for money all the time. And became kind of human in that moment. I mean, it was all true stuff as well. I mean, the real Bina never gives interviews, but she does give interviews in the guise of her robot doppelganger. And all this stuff was true. And it was an extraordinary moment of connection between human and robot.
And this story just has amazing parts to it. You later have an interview with Martine, who had this robot created. We'll set that aside. You have to read the book to read that. But I did want to talk about a little about one of the more chilling stories in Lost at Sea. And it's about former pop star Jonathan King. If anybody remembers him, they might remember a single he had called Everybody's Gone to the Moon. He became a music promoter. He was associated with the Bay City Rollers. And the story is about his prosecution for raping teenage boys and this entire subculture of music promoters who were working with boy bands who served time for the exact same thing. And I got to admit, it was eerily prescient to read that story, given the recent story of the BBC children's show host, who turns out was the most prolific sexual abuser on record. You've probably made those connections yourself.
Yeah, well, it was all based around Radio 1 and BBC Radio 1 in the late 60s, early 1970s. There was an incredibly large number of men who have now been convicted as paedophiles or pederasts. So there was Jonathan King, who ended up... I was with him while he went through his trial, which was a very frustrating experience because he could not see the story from the perspective of his victims. The way to kind of keep his house of cards stacked up was, you know, they were all either blaming their problems on life on some unimportant sex, you know, many years ago, or they were after compensation. He just could not see it from their perspective. And that was the reason why I couldn't, you know, I just couldn't do anything but turn against him. And there was a man called Chris Denning, who was an original Radio 1 DJ. And now, you know, as you said, there's Jimmy Savile, who I don't know how famous he is in America. But
Not too well known here. But were you getting hints of that when you were reporting this story about Jonathan King? Because
Well, there were always rumors about Jimmy Savile. Always. He was a paedophile. And in fact, a friend of mine, Louis Theroux, made a documentary about him and asked him. And he said it wasn't true. But I remember when Jimmy Savile died, Louis Theroux came round to my house and said, you know, what do you think it's going to come out now? You know, do you think, what are we going to find out? And it was worse than anybody could possibly have imagined. He is now Britain's worst ever serial paedophile. You have to wonder, you know, Radio 1, this kind of fun, you know, radio station that everybody listened to in Britain, you know, everybody, has this extraordinarily huge amount of paedophiles. You wonder whether, a bit like I write about in my book, the psychopath test, you know, if you have one psychopath at the top of a business, then maybe, you know, that person's influence then filters down to make everybody behave a little bit more psychopathically. Maybe that's what was going on.
Are there more of these people who you think we'll find out about in the future? A lot of them are older now, but do you think the last shoe has dropped on this story?
I mean, there's a couple of names milling around. The most loved of all the Radio 1 DJs was John Peel, who died. And after his death, a couple of people came and said that he'd had sex with them when they were 15, but were at pains to point out that, you know, he was not a serial abuser like Jimmy Savile. So there was a time when John Peel could easily have been kind of sucked into that, all of that stuff. But, you know, I'm quite happy. I mean, it's so subjective. I'm quite happy that he hasn't been, because I was such a fan of John Peel's. You know, it's a terrible subjective business, isn't it? That was always Jonathan King's defence. It was like, they're going after me, even though I didn't do anything that, you know, Mick Jagger and, you know, these people didn't do in the
1970s. Or Bill Wyman. Young girls, yeah.
Married a 13-year-old girl, Bill Wyman. So that was always Jonathan King's defence, that this is subjective, this is bias. A bit like Joan Alira and Bob Dylan. You know, both make up quotes. Yeah. Everybody forgives Bob Dylan and nobody forgives Joan Alira.
No, not yet. John Ronson is my guest. We're talking about Lost at Sea, his new collection of what he calls the John Ronson Mysteries. He's an extraordinary reporter and writer, and this captures some of his journalism. You've said that you always try to never interview people that you don't like, but you pretty openly admit in several of these stories you grew to dislike these people you were writing about quite intensely. Did that make it a lot harder to write?
Much harder, and on every occasion I wish I hadn't done the story. The worst one in Lost at Sea is a man called Dave McKay, who is the head of a religious group called the Jesus Christians, who actually asked me to do the story. And the story was that because it says in Luke, Luke 13, I think, you know, if you have two coats, you should give one of your coats to a man who has none. His way of interpreting that was maybe his members should all give their spare kidneys to strangers. So they all started doing it and they invited me in to document it. And, you know, of course, in some ways, it was an incredibly philanthropic, wonderful thing they were doing. But when I started probing as to whether Dave was coercing his members into doing it or not, which, by the way, I'm not sure that he was, but I think it was right for me to ask the question, he went crazy and to the extent that this woman in Scotland called Christine needed a kidney, and he sent me a message to say I could instruct one of my members to give her a kidney, but if I did, you would only accuse me of manipulation, so I have decided to let Christine die and let her death be on your conscience. So, when that happened, you know, I wished I hadn't done that story, because that doesn't do anyone any good. You know, yeah. he's the head of a religious sect who is acting like a manipulative cult leader. That doesn't increase people's understanding of the way the world works. That reinforces people's stereotypes. So that's why, you know, I wished I hadn't done that story. But once I was in the midst of it, you just had to go with where it went.
John Ronson, a pleasure to speak with you once again. I hope if you're out in Seattle again, we'll get a chance to have you in the studio with us. It would be terrific to talk to you in person.
Thanks, Russ. It was really good talking to you again.
John Ronson, the latest book, a collection of his articles for The Guardian and other places, is called Lost at Sea, the John Ronson Mysteries. David Hyde produces our program with Arwin Nix, and we get production help from Cameron Drews and Amber Cortez. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. From KUOW, I'm Ross Reynolds.
Hearts full of motors, painted green, mouths full of chocolate, covered cream, arms that can only lift a spoon.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.